Yes, Jones answered. There seems to be four major dialects that we use to convey and feel loved. There are combinations and subgroups, too, I suppose, but basically four. Okay, I prompted. I know about spoken words of approval and favors and deeds. What are the others? The third dialect, Jones began, is one of physical contact. This can be from a simple pat on the back all the way up to the other end of the spectrum, a sexual relationship. A quick back rub, a head scratch, a hug or kiss. These are all common forms of this dialect. People who speak the dialect of physical contact tend to feel most loved when affection is expressed in this form. Sometimes that's the only way they feel loved. And that's how they show their love as well? I asked. Absolutely, Joan said. It's not right or wrong. It's just the only dialect they understand. So for the sake of conversation, consider the person who speaks physical contact to be like a cat. I raised my eyebrows. Excuse me? Cats are almost exclusively creatures of physical contact, Jones answered, himself grinning like the Cheshire Cat. You don't really have to feed them. You know cats. If a cat's hungry, he'll kill something. Cats don't pay attention to what you say or do. No reason to call one. He wouldn't come if he did. Cats just want to be rubbed and scratched. That's how they feel love. And how does a cat express love? A cat will rub against you with its face or its back. Touch me, a cat is saying. Some people are the same way. Ha! That is so true, I exclaimed. Amazing! And what about the fourth dialect? Well, number four would be love expressed in quality time, Jones said. To a person who speaks this dialect, it doesn't matter if you touch them, do something for them, or tell them repeatedly that you love them. The only thing that matters is quality time together. Now, you're not a quality time person, Andy, Jones said with a laugh, but let me ask you something. Has your wife ever said something like, I wish we spent more time together, or you're just not around that much? I nodded uncertainly, beginning to suspect his conclusion, and answered, well, as a matter of fact, yes, she does. And you know, I work at home, so I always thought, what do you mean I'm not around? How could we spend more time together? Holy cow, I'm here all day long. Yes, you are there all day long, Jones avowed, but not with her. Your wife speaks the dialect of quality time. She craves time alone with only you. This is how she expresses her love. And for you to have a wife who is happy and who feels secure in your love, you must learn to speak this dialect. It is expressed by giving her periods of undivided attention, listening to the details of her day, her dreams, and concerns. To be honest, I feel kind of ridiculous that I never knew this, I confessed. I don't, Jones said with a wave of his hand. Why would you know it? We grow up expecting everyone else to be just like us, and they aren't. But now that you know... Yeah, now that I know, I can do something about it. I paused, trying to take it all in, then had a thought. Hey, Jones, you said that physical touch people were like cats. I grinned mischievously. Is there an animal that you use to represent quality time? The old man ducked his head sheepishly. Yes, son, I do. I've always likened a person who receives and expresses love by quality time to a canary. A canary says, just be with me. A canary never really notices who gives it food or water. It doesn't care what you say to it and certainly doesn't need to be touched. A canary is happiest when you just sit and listen carefully to its song. And a canary that is ignored will die, not from a lack of food, but from a lack of love and attention. What am I, Jones? I asked then, studying his face. You, my friend, Jones said with amusement, are a puppy dog. You, I am quite sure, feel loved by spoken words of approval. That is exactly right, I laughed. But why a puppy dog? Well, think about it, Jones said. Tell a puppy how wonderful he is, and his whole body wags. And how do you teach a puppy most effectively? With praise. Good boy. There's a good doggy. But here's a word of caution to those who love a puppy dog. or a person who speaks the dialect of spoken words of approval. Nothing, and I mean nothing, is more devastating than words of disapproval spoken in an angry tone of voice. Puppies cower as if they are under attack, and so do people who express and receive love in this dialect. Okay, we have cats, canaries, and puppy dogs. I was counting them off on my fingers. What is the animal for favors and deeds? That's a person like Jan, right? Right, Joan said. Jan and people like her are goldfish. I laughed out loud. Ha! I'm sure she'll be glad to hear that, I said. And I'm sure you're going to tell her, he fired back at me with a twinkle in his eye. Jones, I responded, still laughing, I'm going to tell everybody. He shrugged. Well, might not be a bad thing for folks to know. It isn't just married couples that can make use of this knowledge. These dialects, when you get good at spotting them, can help you communicate with your kids, your friends, even people with whom you work. Yeah, no matter the age or relationship, everybody, every single body, speaks a dialect. Won't the world be a better place when we understand them all? I thought about that for a moment, then remembered. Jones, why is Jan a goldfish? Well, a goldfish feels loved based purely on favors and deeds. You can't really touch them. I don't know if they can hear you, even if you do talk to them, so they don't want your affirmation. And as far as quality time, they don't care if you're there or not. A goldfish just wants you to feed them and clean the bowl. And, oh, yeah, straighten the castle while you're in there. I hooted in laughter. You really have it nailed, Jones. Well, he said modestly, it's just something I noticed over the years. Just a little different perspective on how we relate to one another. He stood, stretched, and remarked, getting to be late afternoon. About time, I'm sure, for you to go on home and spend a little quality time with that pretty wife of yours. I stood, too, ready to go, but then suddenly uneasy. It occurred to me just how much I owed this old man, a person about whom I knew virtually nothing, and yet somehow I loved him, and I knew he loved me. Jones, I started, are you sure you won't come home? Hey, I appreciate it. I really do, he said, but I'm fine. I'm not hungry, cold, or wet. Don't you worry about old Jones. Actually, I have another appointment, so scat, okay? And he smiled at me, picked up his suitcase, and walked off the pier. At my car, I asked, will I see you again? While you're here, I mean? Oh, yeah, he answered. Now, I'll be here for a while. Keep looking for me. Then he swept his hands over his T-shirt and jeans. I'll be the one wearing this.
Chapter 4 Jones crossed the beach road and began to walk through the state park. Within an hour, darkness had begun to fall, and the rich reds and purples of the evening sky created a compelling stage for the night sounds. Traversing the park's first tiny bridge, the old man listened to the frogs and crickets singing in the brackish swamp. Then he heard a soft rush of air overhead and looked up to see an owl beginning its evening hunt. Slowing, as if he recognized the area, Jones heard a splash of what he imagined to be a large fish or a small alligator. He stopped beside an old pine and placed his battered suitcase on its side, sat down on it, and leaned his back against the base of the tree. Traffic was light on the road. It was used mostly by the locals as a shortcut to reach Highway 59. Tourists rarely ventured this way. Jones wasn't tired, still. He closed his eyes. Walker Miles rarely took this route, and wouldn't have done so this evening had the traffic light on the beach road not been red. It was a long light, he knew, so to avoid the wait, he made a right turn into the park. As he drove the tightly curved road in his mid-sized sedan, Walker thought about his life. He was a pharmaceutical sales rep, 53 years old and single, again, having divorced for the second time only 4 months earlier. He had moved to the beach in hopes of a new start. His vacations in the past had been enjoyable in this area, Walker had reasoned, so his intention was to live where there seemed to be at least a chance for happiness. After all, a chance for happiness was all he could hope for anymore. At least that's how he felt. Always. For Walker, Happiness was an elusive moving target that seemed to perpetually flit just beyond his grasp. His thoughts were consumed by possibilities of problems and mistakes, personal slights and professional sabotage. Lately, he had even been contemplating suicide. Walker's first wife, Kendra, had left, explaining that she could no longer live with a man whose emotional role model was the donkey Eeyore from Winnie the Pooh. His second wife, Deborah, on her way out, had alluded to another character from a children's book. "Walker," she had said sadly, "the sky is not always falling. I hope one day you'll realize that." But tonight, he was depressed, a familiar state for him, and tired. As Walker's headlights came on, he drove over the park's first bridge and saw a figure just past it, sitting several yards off the road. Bum. Drifter. Old. Really old. The thoughts that ran through Walker's mind as he glanced at the man were not flattering. He was certainly not inclined to slow down, much less stop, so when he did, Walter muttered to himself, "What are you doing?" For a moment, Walker just sat there, in the middle of the road, then, with a sigh, he shook his head, checked the rearview mirror, and slowly backed up, mumbling, "I am an idiot." When the car paralleled the old man, Walker rolled down the passenger window and peered cautiously into the semi-darkness. The old man lifted a hand in greeting. "How do you do?" he called. "Do you need help?" Walker asked in response. The old man did not answer, but stood, picked up whatever he had been sitting on, and eased over to the car. As the man approached, Walker rolled the window almost to the top. Every fiber of his being was screaming at him to drive away, leave this place, and get away from this creepy situation, but for some reason he did not move. "I'm sorry," the old man said kindly as he stopped beside Walker's car. "Did you ask me a question? I don't hear as quite as well as I used to." Walker faltered as he looked up at the old man, whose white hair and blue eyes stood out in stark relief to the muted colors in the faded lights around him. "Say again?" the old man prompted. "Well," Walker said, I was just wondering if you needed help." "Whew," the old man sighed, shaking his head as if in wonder. "Don't we all? Don't we all? I beg your pardon—" "Oh, young man, you don't have to beg," the old man interrupted. "I'll ride with you." And with that, he opened the door and got in, him and his suitcase, before Walker could protest. Shocked, Walker didn't know whether to be angry and demand that the intruder leave or get out of the car himself, and he was certain, or thought he was certain, that he had locked the car door. But before Walker could utter a word, his uninvited guest held out his hand. "Jones," he said simply. "No mister to it." Then, opening his eyes widely, as if seeing the younger man clearly for the first time, he added, "Say, you're Walker Miles. I'm sorry I didn't recognize you." Frowning, Walker said, "Am I supposed to, do I know you?" "No," Jones said. "I saw you in Dr. Surik's office a week ago. You wouldn't remember me, but I heard him say your name a time or two. I don't forget a name, or a face, it looks like." Walker was still leery. He called on doctors all the time in the area, Chris Surik included, but he rarely paid attention to any of their patients. Was this man sick? He wondered. "You said you needed help," Walker prompted. Jones blinked innocently. "Did I? Oh, well, how about a ride to Foley? You're going that way, right?" Walker eased off the brake and turned the overhead light off at the same time, keeping an eye on the strange old man next to him. "Yeah, I'm going to Foley," he said, as he began to speed up. "Any particular place you want to be dropped off?" "No, I don't think I am particularly particular tonight." Jones chuckled at his word choice, then saw that the younger man had not joined him with even a smile. He tried another tack. "I was in a city one night, Chicago it was, come to think of it. I saw a man chase a hat that had blown off someone's head into the street. A car hit him and killed him dead." Walker glanced at the old man, disgusted, and said, "Why on earth would you tell me that?" "I just think it's amazing," Jones answered,
looking straight ahead, that a person could lose everything, chasing nothing.
Neither spoke for a moment. The car's headlights wound through the park, dancing off the blacktop and flaring among the trees. Walker drove as if he were concentrating on where he was going, but inside he was merely being haunted by where he had already been. He flexed his fingers on the steering wheel and finally answered with a sigh, "Well, that's me." Jones shifted in the seat and clucked his tongue.
"Yeah, that's everybody one time or another. But why do you say it's you?"
Walker's mind raced. He was intelligent, sane, and from a good family. He could not rationally come up with one single reason why he had stopped for this old man in the first place. Now he was about to reveal his most private thoughts, and he did not want to. But strangely, it was as if Walker were watching someone else have the conversation. Logic warned him to keep quiet, but something more powerful gave him a sense of well-being, of trust. He relaxed and began to talk to Jones as if he had known him for years. Walker told him about growing up, about being the youngest of three kids, about the pain of his father's alcoholism. He talked about his own marriages and the many jobs he'd held, most successful for a time, but ultimately ending because of his own inability to be happy. And on he went, baring his soul as if to an old friend. By the time Walker had told Jones everything there was to tell, they were on their fourth refill of coffee at a Waffle House. Once again, Walker was still overcome with amazement that he was here at all, talking to this old-timer, but he admitted to himself that it was as if he had found a long-lost friend. "To a degree," Walker said, "I suppose I've always felt like a loser because my dad was an alcoholic." "Well," Jones answered innocently, "maybe your dad was an alcoholic because you were a loser."
Then he laughed and held up his hands as if to fend off Walker's blows. "Just kidding, just kidding."
Walker wasn't certain whether he should be offended or not.
"Look, young man," Jones went on a bit more seriously, "your father and his problems are in the past. Here he is, dead, and you're still dragging this 'my dad was an alcoholic' thing around. It's time to stop letting your history control your destiny."
"I know, I know," Walker said, his eyes closed now. "I know this. I know I shouldn't think so much about the past. I know I shouldn't worry. I know I should have nothing to be depressed about."
He opened his eyes and looked at Jones with all the frustration of 53 years boiling over. Then, trying to speak quietly, though he felt like screaming, Walker said, "I really am aware. I just can't stop. These feelings have ruined my life."
He paused, and then in a broken whisper said, "I don't know what to do." Jones reached out, took Walker by the forearm, and squeezed gently. Walker instantly relaxed and began to breathe deeply.
"Look into my eyes, son," the old man said then, and Walker did. "There isn't any drastic action you need to be taking because you feel this way," the old man said. "Like all things that seem a big deal, this ain't a big deal, okay?"
Walker nodded. Jones seemed to relax a bit, then he took a deep breath and announced,
"There are two things you need to know about how you feel, and one thing you need to do. The first thing you need to know is that you worry or you feel this crazy fear because you're smart."
Walker's face fell and he sat back in the booth.
"Hang on now," the old man softly scolded as if he had read Walker's mind. "I'm not being condescending. I'm not trying to shine you on. This is truth. Just a little different perspective. You are a logical young man, so sit still. You'll appreciate this."
Jones smiled, took a sip of his coffee, and started again.
"You worry," he said, "because you're smart, like I said."
The old man looked around as if to keep a secret, then added,
"The dumber folks among us don't worry much. They ain't afraid of nothing."
Walker's brow furrowed in confusion, so Jones explained,
"Here it is, young man. Smart people are generally more creative and imaginative than dumb people. You agree, right?
Walker still had no idea where the old man was going.
I suppose, he said. Well, that's why smart people get tripped up with worry and fear. Worry, fear, it's just a misuse of the creative imagination that has been placed in each of us. Because we are smart and creative, we imagine all the things that could happen, that might happen, that will happen if this or that happens. See what I mean?
Walker had begun to nod attentively, and the beginning of a smile was emerging on his face.
That's me, he said. Not the smart part.
Jones waved him off.
I know what you mean. Anyway, he continued, dumb people, on the other hand, don't worry about anything. They aren't afraid of anything. You've seen the TV shows. The only thing crazier than the guy that says, watch this, is the guy that says, heck, I can do that.
Walker laughed out loud with the old man.
I guess you're right, he said. Sure, I'm right, Jones replied. Smart people, like you, consistently misuse the creative imagination that has been placed inside them to scream fire where there isn't even any smoke.
So how do I turn that part of me off? Walker asked.
It is a problem. I do worry about things that logically should not even be in my head.
If you know that logically these doubts and fears should not even be in your head, then the easiest way to defeat them is with logic.
Walker stared intently but shook his head.
I don't understand. You will, Jones replied. So those are the two things you need to know. One, that you think the way you do because you're smart, and two, you have to defeat those thoughts with logic.
Jones shifted in the booth, put both elbows on the table, and, concentrating hard on the man in front of him, said,
When doubts and fears assail us, we subconsciously calculate the possibilities. This might really happen, we tell ourselves, or what will happen if...
He leaned a little closer.
And soon we are so paralyzed by the idea that disaster is imminent that we cannot function in our work and even our relationships dissolve. We've imagined our way to self-destruction. And that's what has happened to you, my friend. What you must do to defeat bad logic with good is to deflect your subconscious from calculating possibilities. Instead, direct your mind to calculate the odds. You can learn very quickly to calculate the odds of an event occurring and eliminate it as even a remote possibility in your life.
Then, borrowing a pen from the waitress, Jones said, Consider what I am about to give you to be an authoritative estimate on the things you worry about. Reaching for his napkin, he wrote down, 40%. Then he raised his eyes to Walker.
40%, he said. 40% of the things you worry about will never occur anyway.
Returning his gaze to the napkin, Jones next wrote, 30%.
30%, he said, looking up again, of the things that you worry about are things that have already happened in the past. And all the worry in the world ain't going to change what's already happened, right?
Walker nodded in agreement. Jones wrote 12% on the napkin.
I'm thinking 12% of all worries have to do with needless imaginings about our health. My leg hurts. Do I have cancer? My head hurts. Do I have a tumor? My daddy died of a heart attack when he was 60 and I'm 59.
Jones looked up.
You get me?
I do.
10%, he said next as he wrote, would be petty little nothing worries about what other people think.
He looked up.
And we can't do nothing about what other people think.
Walker tilted his head to read the napkin that was upside down in front of him.
So if my math is right, he said, that leaves 8%.
He looked at Jones.
8% for what? 8%, Jones answered, for legitimate concerns.
He held up a finger.
But it should be noted that these legitimate concerns are things that can actually be dealt with. Most people spend so much time fearing the things that are never going to happen or can't be controlled that they have no energy to deal with the few things they can actually handle.
That's me, Walker said simply.
Not anymore, Jones answered. Now tell me, What are the immediate thoughts in your mind, say, during the first 10 minutes after you wake up every morning?
Walker shrugged.
You know, what I have to do, who I have to call, the things I need to deal with first, I guess. These would be your most pressing challenges of the day?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, Jones began. I'm not saying that you don't think about the things you have to do, but I want you to mix in some other thoughts as well. Leave a pad and pen beside your bed, and when you wake up, grab it, and take it everywhere with you for the first 10 minutes or so of your morning. On that pad, I want you to list things in your life that you are grateful for. You can list names, objects, feelings, anything. Remember to list clean sheets and a roof over your head, knowing there are millions who spent the night without either. As you eat breakfast or skip it, remember the millions who have none. Be generous and creative as you list the many things you have to be grateful for, young man. Don't be shy about writing the same ones down every day, and write them down. Thinking about this will not do the trick. Jones smiled widely. But then you already know that. After all, it is your own imagination with which you are doing battle. Jones leaned back now and set his pen down with a finality that said he was drawing their time to a close. You will feel differently from now on, Jones said, leaning back. Many people who worry too much say that they cannot focus, that it costs them their jobs and relationships. That is incorrect. A person consumed by worry can focus. Isn't it obvious? Worry is focus, but it is focus on the wrong things. Young man, Jones said to Walker, you are now equipped to calculate the odds. From this point forward, you will focus on what can be controlled, and you will no longer be sad or worried. You will be grateful. After all, the seeds of depression cannot take root in a grateful heart. Now wash up, Jones ordered, pointing Walker out of the booth and into the restroom. Walker stood and gazed awkwardly at Jones for a moment. Then he placed his hand on the old man's shoulder. Thank you, Jones, he said solemnly. You know, if I hadn't run into you tonight, I might have... Go, Jones said gently, clapping his palm over the hand on his shoulder. I know. And you're welcome. Less than 2 minutes later, Walker came out of the restroom to find the check paid and the old man gone. Chapter 5 Do you know Jones? Robert Kraft asked me as we stood on the clubhouse steps. Robert was the owner of Kraft Farms, one of the nicest golf clubs on the Gulf Coast, and the place I had come on this day for lunch. Yes, I do, I answered, glancing down the length of the building where Jones stood, foot on his suitcase, surrounded by young people. Guys and girls, most appeared to be in their late teens or early 20s. They were laughing, hanging on the old man's every word. Who are the kids? Bag attendants, wait staff, grains maintenance. You're looking at all the young people who work here who aren't supposed to be doing something else right now. Robert grinned and added, and probably a few who are supposed to be doing something else. How do you know Jones? I asked Robert. Daddy knew him, he answered, still looking at the gaggle of youth surrounding the old man. Before Daddy ever met Mama, Jones helped him out of some jam. Robert turned to me. It wasn't a big deal, you know, one of those here's another way of looking at it kind of things, but Daddy never forgot it, or him. Do you see him often? I asked. Robert got a strange look on his face. Do you? He came back. I asked first, I said, and we both laughed. Looking back toward the old man, Robert said, I asked Daddy one time what Jones looked like when he was younger. Daddy said he looked just like that. Robert jerked a thumb in Jones' direction. Then, remembering my question, he added, I guess I've seen him, 10, 12 different periods in my life. What do you mean, periods? You know, he stays around for a while, then he's gone for a while. Like that. He snapped his fingers. Sometimes he's gone so long I forget about him, but he always comes back. Robert gazed out across the 18th fairway. Daddy started this, you know, he said with a broad sweep of his arm across the landscape. It was all gladiola fields, for it was a golf course. When I took over several years ago, Daddy told me to let the old man have run to the place. Really? Mm-hmm. He doesn't play golf, just hangs around, talks to people.
I'll see him sometimes in the dining room or out by the putting green in some serious conversation with someone or another. I don't know where he sleeps, or for that matter, if he sleeps. He never sleeps around here. We try to comp his meals, Robert continued, but he always pays. Big tipper, too, waitstaff says. I don't know where he gets the money. I guess he keeps it in that suitcase. God knows there can't be any clothes in there. He always wears the same thing. Another burst of laughter erupted from the group surrounding the old man. Robert smiled and shook his head. They love him. Curious, I asked, do you mind him being here? He doesn't look the country club type, you know. Then I motioned toward Robert's employees. Is he taking up too much of their time?
I gotta tell you, Robert said, if I could figure out a way to make the old man stay here, I would.
These kids walk on air after they talk with him. They're better. They're sharper in every way. My son, you know Mitch, he tells me he gives them advice, just little things, mind you, but they listen. And the old man's advice works.
He shook his head in wonder. When have you ever seen a bunch of kids interested in an eccentric old guy like that? Then he added, and have you heard the talk around town? It isn't just the kids. People are, like, looking him up or something, seeking him out. And you know Jones, he'll talk to anybody.
Robert paused, thinking. He's been around longer this time, I think, he said finally. Jones had looked our way, spotted us, waved, and continued talking with the young people. I shook my head in wonder, too, and softly, only loud enough for Robert to hear, said, Jones.
Not Mr. Jones, Robert responded jokingly.
Oh, no, I said with a snicker, just Jones. As I reached out to give Robert a parting handshake, he said, you know, Daddy didn't call him Jones.
Really? I said. What did he call him?
Well, Daddy met him when he came through with the migrant workers picking the gladiolus. Daddy called him what they did, what they still do. They call him Garcia.
Jones had already said goodbye to most of the kids who had either drifted to their cars in the parking lot or back to work. But as he moved toward the shade of the clubhouse porch overlooking the lake, he noticed three of the young people hadn't left.
"Where are you going, Jones?" asked Caroline, the tall girl beside him. "You want a Coke?" she said. "You guys?" she asked the others. Then, without waiting for an answer, said, "Four Cokes," and headed for the clubhouse.
Caroline had long red hair. She was taller than Jones, pretty in a casual sort of way, a high school senior and one of the most popular kids in the area. Caroline's father was a mortgage banker, her mother active in community affairs. The family seemed to have it all together. As he walked toward the porch, Jones glanced at Amelia, Caroline's best friend, who was walking alongside him. Amelia, a sophomore in college and home on spring break, was 2 years older than Caroline. Amelia was a liberal arts major whose family history was, as she put it, cloudy. Next to Amelia was Richie Weber, a handsome 17-year-old. The small group stepped up onto the porch and walked around back, away from the entrance. Jones eased himself into one of the white rocking chairs, as did Amelia beside him. Caroline approached shortly, distributed the soft drinks, and sat on the porch's wooden floor. Richie perched on the rail, with his back to the lake.
"What do you want to talk about, Jones?" Richie said.
The young man's dark, mocha-colored skin gleamed in the early afternoon sun, and his clear face and straight teeth made him look like an actor or model. Extremely sharp-witted, Richie put his efforts into academics, eschewing the usual sports, except golf. With his high GPA, he had already been assured a full scholarship in the fall.
"Me?" Jones asked Richie with false innocence. "I didn't want to talk about anything. I was coming over here to take a nap."
"Come on," Caroline teased, bumping the old man with the pink flip-flop on her foot. "You know you want us here. You love us. So talk, Jones."
The old man chuckled and took a sip of his drink.
"Okay, let's talk. But you start. Young man?"
Jones raised his styrofoam cup to Richie.
"You first. Ask a question."
"Okay," Richie said eagerly. "Here you go. How do you keep a marriage from ending in divorce?"
Jones feigned surprise.
"Wow," he said. "Nothing easy from you. How about what'll the Cubs do this year, or when will the trout start biting?"
Richie just waited expectantly.
"That's your subject?" Jones asked finally. "Are you sure?"
I'm sure, Richie said.
Jones took a deep breath and blew it out.
Okay. Are you married?
The two girls tittered.
Jones, Richie all but shouted. You know I'm not married.
He's got some girlfriends, though, Caroline teased.
If you aren't married, Jones asked without any hint of guile, then why do you care about how you keep a marriage from ending in divorce?
Richie shrugged.
My parents are about the only ones I know who are married to their original...
Mine, too, Caroline interrupted.
Okay, Richie corrected. Then mine and yours. Anyway, lots of guys and girls are getting married pretty young. People we know.
He looked at his two companions for agreement, and they nodded.
But it seems like they all get divorced after a few years, he went on. So long story short, the reason I'm asking how to keep a marriage from ending in divorce is because there has to be something you can learn while you're dating. I mean, I hope there is. You're a wise young man, Jones said, his chair rocking slowly. It's obvious you kids are smart. School and good teachers will do that for you, but wisdom is something altogether different. Wisdom can be gathered in your downtime. Wisdom that can change the very course of your life will come from the people you are around, the books you read, and the things you listen to or watch on radio or television. Of course, bad information is gathered in your downtime, too. Bad information that can change the very course of your life will come from the people you are around, the books you read, and the things you listen to or watch on radio or television.
Richie, Caroline, and Amelia listened carefully. They had been around Jones long enough to know that he rarely answered a question directly. There was always some greater envelope around the nugget of truth he dispensed.
One of wisdom's greatest benefits, Jones continued, is accurate discernment. The learned ability to immediately tell right from wrong, good from evil, acceptable from unacceptable. Time well spent from time wasted. The right decision from the wrong decision. And many times this is simply a matter of having the correct perspective.
Okay, Jones, Richie said. We knew you'd get around to your favorite word eventually, but how does perspective relate to wisdom?
Here's the connection, Jones said. One way to define wisdom is the ability to see into the future the consequences of your choices in the present. That ability can give you a completely different perspective on what the future might look like. Here's how it works in its highest earthly form. Wisdom will allow a person to split the hair of choice so accurately that most men would say it is impossible.
Jones spoke in a low tone so that the young people had to lean toward him to hear.
So listen to me now. Pinpoint accuracy in choices of all kinds is a possibility for you. You see, with a degree of intelligence and a hint of wisdom, most people can tell the difference between good and bad. However, it takes a truly wise person to discern that oh-so-thin line between good and best. And that line, my friends, is the line that separates a roll of the dice about your future from a sure thing, from trying, as the Bible says, to see through a dark glass and having a perspective that allows you to see clearly the long-term consequences of your choices. How does all this relate to choosing a partner for life? Just the difference between a marriage made on earth from a marriage made in heaven.
Jones, no offense, Amelia said, but what does this have to do with Richie's question that I can barely remember anymore?
They all laughed, Jones included.
No offense taken. All right, he said. Most folks think marriage is about commitment, and it is. But the committing is a whole heck of a lot easier if you've made a wise choice to begin with. That's why I know the young man here, Jones indicated Richie, is going to have a better marriage than most folks. Why? Because he is already seeking and gathering wisdom that will help him make the perfect choice. Now,
Jones turned his gaze to the ceiling fan above them and said,
let's excavate this situation a little more before we sift through the dirt to see where we are.
He looked at Amelia.
Young lady, why do folks get married?
Amelia instantly reddened and wondered if she was being tested. She opened her mouth and clamped it shut.
It ain't a trick question, Jones prompted. Just why?
Okay. Because they love each other?
Is that all?
Amelia laughed.
I don't know what you want me to say.
No wrong answers, Jones said. We're just excavating here. So, because they love each other and...
Because they love each other and they want to spend the rest of their lives together, Amelia said in a rush.
Jones turned to Caroline.
And how do you know that you love someone enough to get married? He asked her.
Well, Caroline began tentatively, that person is the only person you want to be around. You think about them constantly. You want to hold them. You want to do it with them,
Richie cut in, his eyebrows wiggling. Caroline gave him a dirty look.
That was such a guy thing to say, Richie, Amelia said scornfully.
Yeah, well, he responded, not in the least bit contrite. I'm a guy. There you go. Okay, okay, Jones interrupted with a chuckle. Actually, that's part of it, right? The physical attraction?
Three heads bobbed affirmatively.
But how do you know you love someone enough to spend the rest of your life together?
Jones looked from one young person to the other. None spoke. Finally, Caroline said,
I never really thought of that.
Nobody else gives much thought to it either, Jones answered, his face sad.
For a moment, the three friends sat in silence, digesting what they thought the old man had just told them. Then Richie spoke up.
Jones, are you saying that now, while we are dating, while we are young, we should be thinking about who we want to spend the rest of our lives with?
I don't know, Jones answered. What do you think?
The alternative is that you spend your young years dating and not thinking about who you want to spend the rest of your life with. Does that seem wise to you?
Silence. Jones let them stew a bit, then said,
Think with old Jones now. Here's what happens in most of those marriages you asked me about earlier. And I want to make myself clear. I'm not talking about what we can do to make an existing marriage better. We're not covering every base here. I'm telling you one aspect of what happens in normal marriages every day. A young man and young woman spot each other across a crowded room, and sparks fly.
Caroline giggled.
Shh, Richie scolded. Go on, Jones.
They meet and soon are in love. They can't bear to be apart. Every moment they are apart is spent thinking about the other.
Jones spoke dramatically, batting his eyelashes for effect.
And when they are together, it is all the two can do to keep their hands off each other. If they could kiss day and night, they would.
Okay, we get it, Amelia said. They're in love.
Yes, Jones agreed. They are. In fact, they are so in love that each has become more important to the other than anything else in their lives. You see, the girl has a passion for horses. All her life she has ridden horses, read horse magazines, dreamed of the horses she would own. But the young man is allergic to horses. He can't be around them. He wouldn't if he could. They're huge, and they scare him. But that gal of his loves him so much that quietly, with no one even aware of her thought process, she decides, he is much more important to me than the horses. I don't necessarily need horses in my life. And she chooses her young man, her love. Now, the young man is just as crazy about her as she is him. He loves her, Jones said, pooching his lips as he said the word love, eliciting giggles from his young friends. But the thing about him, Jones continued, is that he grew up fishing. Since he was a little boy, this young man has fished with his family, fishing and football. Nothing like it. If he wasn't fishing, he was watching football.
And I'll bet she hates to fish, Richie said.
Can't stand it, Jones concurred. She isn't really a water person. Doesn't like to eat fish either. And, Jones affected a look of horror, she thinks football is stupid.
Here we go, Amelia began.
No, no, Jones said. Everything is all right. Because he loves her so much. He is willing to do anything, sacrifice anything, just so he can spend the rest of his life with her. So quietly, With no one even aware that he is doing so, the young man makes a decision. She is so much more important to me than fishing, he tells himself. I don't need to fish. Why do I need to fish when I have her? And football? Well, I like it, but it's not nearly as important as her. Jones spread his hands. And there you have it, he said.
There we have what? Richie asked. What? What do they do?
They get married, of course, Jones laughed. And that is your answer to why so many marriages end in divorce.
The three young people looked confusedly at one another. Clearly, they all decided neither had any idea what point the old man was trying to make.
Jones, Amelia said slowly, we don't get it. What happened? Why would their marriage end in divorce? Isn't that what everybody does? Compromise? Aren't there just some things you, well, live with? Like whether they squeeze the toothpaste tube from the bottom or the middle?
Jones smiled and patted Amelia's hand. Then he stood up and motioned for Richie to take his chair. Leaning against the porch rail with his back to the lake so he could see all three young people at once, the old man smiled gently and said, Yes, if it was as simple as a toothpaste tube, there probably wouldn't be any problems. See, these two fell hard for each other and let a physical attraction trump everything in its way. Don't get me wrong, I'm not saying physical attraction is not important. It is. But you can be physically attracted to a lot of people. You don't believe me? Turn on the TV. Walk down the beach. Here's my point. Somewhere along the line, there has to be something to share when the physical attraction is not on your mind 24 hours a day. Because here's what happens. After 3 months or 3 years, sometime you can be sure the physical thing won't be the absolute number one most important thing in that couple's life. There will be some other things that begin to be important, too. Now, a lot of young ladies at this point begin to think, Gosh, am I just going to spend the rest of my entire life never riding a horse? And young men start thinking, Holy cow, am I really willing to live the rest of my life not fishing? Can I never watch football ever again? In my life?
Caroline, Amelia, and Richie remained quiet. They understood, but Jones hammered the point home.
Pretty soon, he concluded, that guy at the office with horse pictures on his wall is a comforting ear to the young lady. The waitress at the restaurant, the cute one who always knows the football scores, she understands the young man's problems. Nobody meant for it to happen, but remember, you can be attracted to a lot of people.
That's a pretty sad picture, Jones, Amelia said.
Gee, happens every day, the old man said with a sigh. Doesn't have to happen to you, though.
How can we avoid it? Caroline asked.
Well, hey, Richie said, that's fairly obvious, isn't it? I mean, just be careful not to fall in love or lust or whatever with someone you don't want to hang with.
Yeah, but I don't think it's that simple, Amelia said. Remember, Joan said that the guy and the girl decided quietly that they would compromise without anyone even knowing they were doing so. And there's also the fact that we hide our true selves sometimes. What if my guy never told me he didn't like horses?
Again, they all looked at Jones. He shrugged and said,
Well, of course, one is always susceptible to a skillful liar. But barring that, there is a wonderful filter most of us possess that allows us to determine if a young man or woman is suitable as a potential life partner.
What filter? Caroline asked.
Your friends, Joan said simply. Your family, too, for sure, but nothing filters a true person like friends.
Explain, Richie requested.
Curiously, it usually works in reverse from what most of us expect. For instance, young man, Jones said to Richie, you probably thought that I meant your friends should pass judgment on your young lady. Is that correct?
Richie looked at the two girls, whose faces indicated that this is what they had assumed as well.
Yes, that's what I thought you meant. No, Jones said. What you are interested in is whether or not she likes your friends. Now, assuming that you hang with good people, wise friends, does she encourage your participation in activities with your friends? Does she enjoy being a part of that group? Does she fit in, or does she try to keep you away from your friends? Does she want to keep you alone with her all the time? I can promise you one thing, young people, Jones said to all three of them. If your boyfriend or girlfriend is constantly trying to keep you alone and away from your family and friends, something is wrong. This is a huge leaf you should pay attention to.
A huge what? Amelia asked. A leaf?
Jones stopped to explain. Yes, a leaf. A leaf is an indicator. One can walk through the forest and never look up, but you can pick up a single leaf and know all sorts of information about the tree you are under. By examining a single leaf, you can tell the season of the year, whether the tree is large or small, whether it is poisonous or has fruit you can eat. Yes, sir. You can tell a lot about a tree from a single leaf. You can tell a lot about a person from the leaves they drop as well. You don't have to be around someone a long time to know what their life is about. You can just examine the occasional leaf they drop. Believe me, that'll tell it all.
Wow, Amelia said. If this is all true, and I don't doubt that it is, then I seriously need to break up with my boyfriend.
Better now than later, right, Jones? Richie said.
Jones remained silent.
Your boyfriend at the university? Caroline asked.
Amelia nodded unhappily.
Do your friends like him?
That wasn't the point, Richie said. Remember?
I know, Caroline answered. I was just, you know.
Actually, Amelia offered, I don't really know what my friends think about him. I mean, really.
Our friends aren't always forthcoming about these matters, Joan said. Often they don't want to hurt our feelings, or maybe we filter any negative comments out because of our blind attraction to our boyfriend or girlfriend. A true friend will be honest with you, however, if you request it. Just be ready to listen. Sometimes we ignore the leaves piling up at our feet while a true friend has managed to snag a few.
This all seems so hard, Caroline said sadly.
No, young lady, Jones responded. It's really not. It's just different. Think this way for a little bit, and it'll be the most natural thing in the world. Do you remember our definition of wisdom? The ability to see into the future the consequences of your choices in the present. Your family, your true friends, they have been placed in your life for a reason. They can help you gain perspective on whatever situation you are in. They are a resource. Pay attention.
Jones reached down, took Caroline's hand, and brought her to her feet. Amelia stood, and Richie thrust his right hand toward Jones. Their time was up.
One more question, Richie said as he shook the old man's hand.
Jones' eyebrows lifted in anticipation.
You know Emilio, right? The kid who works with the Greens crew?
Yeah,
Jones answered.
Why does he call you Garcia?
Jones grinned.
Why wouldn't he? Don't I look Hispanic to you?
Honestly, Richie said, I always thought you were black.
Does it make a difference?
Jones asked, looking from Richie to Caroline to Amelia.
Well, no.
No, of course not.
Jones smiled broadly.
There you go, then, he said,
as he stepped off the porch and sauntered across the parking lot.
Chapter 6. The pink and purple azalea blossoms were so full that they overpowered even the dogwoods and redbud, blocking out any hint of the green leaves that lurked beneath them. 76 springs now, Willow Calloway had watched them bloom. She moved slowly from her front porch, through the yard to the road, and waited for the traffic to pass. Willow lived on Canal Road, about a mile west of the big curve. Canal Road is formerly known as Highway 180, but only the tourists call it that. As she waited, the old woman thought back to when the road was a simple dirt track. Now she had to stand and endure the fumes and pace of people she hadn't asked to move here, folks she didn't understand, who were loud and unappreciative of the way things once were.
Willow remembered when she and her children would ease out of the house about this time of the evening and play by the banks of the canal. They would wave to the men on the barges and make up guessing games about the faraway places to which they were bound. Now the tugs and barges were air-conditioned, and nobody came outside to wave. Still, though, she sat and watched. Willow stepped quickly across the road and moved toward the only bench within sight. It wasn't in a park. There was no light above it, no garbage can beside it, no fish cleaning station or water hose or sign nearby about what was or wasn't permitted, just a simple bench set beside another just like it. They sat side by side on a tiny dock no larger than 15 feet square. Her husband had built the dock and benches decades ago. By the time the small structure had been proudly placed on the canal bank, the children had already gone, leaving the house empty except for Willow and Bobby Gray, the man she married when she was 16. Many evenings were spent on one bench or the other, sitting there with a big glass of sweet iced tea between them, watching the slow-moving tide, talking about nothing, just being still and feeling God and loving each other until he died. Willow's oldest, Tommy, lived in Dallas now. He had children and even grandchildren of his own. Ray and Martha, the twins, were in Sarasota with the families they'd raised. Bradford, Willow's baby, was gone. Hard to believe she'd outlived one of her own children, but she had. Brad was only 47 when he died. She still thought of him as her baby. Yes, he was a grown man to some, but to her, he had always been the sweet child who ran barefoot, tripping through the honeysuckle vines, who laughed at silly jokes but cried at Christmas that one year, so sad for baby Jesus because he had to be born in a barn. She was proud of what she had accomplished, of the life she had led, but her life was over and it was time to go. That was a fact she had decided months ago, knew it for certain. Yet here she was, hanging around like somebody's forgotten holiday wreath, still on the front door in March. But not inclined to take the matter into her own hands, Willow waited. "Oh, excuse me," she said. Willow had not seen the old man sitting on her dock as she approached, and it was her dock. Even the mayor of Orange Beach had said so in a newspaper article one time. Everyone in town knew her husband had built it, and the dock was right across from her house. No car ever stopped there. No one ever used it. The city mowed around it for her. It was the Willow Calloway dock. She had been so enthralled with the azaleas, never suspecting another person might be there, that the old man had taken her quite by surprise. He stood and smiled. "It's a lovely evening," he said, "and the location extraordinary, a view to match." Then, bowing slightly, he added, "Please, Mrs. Calloway, do sit down. I can leave if you wish to be alone, but I would love to join you for a time, if I may."
"Sir," Willow said, "I find myself at a disadvantage, for you obviously know who I am, yet I don't believe I have had the pleasure of being introduced."
He bowed again, this time offering his hand.
"I do apologize, beautiful lady. You are well known in these parts, while I am but a raconteur, a traveling gentleman without means, a common drifter. My name is Jones, madam. Not Mr. Jones, if you will humor me. Just plain Jones."
Willow smiled and held out her hand, allowing the very polite old man to help her to the bench on the right.
"And may I join you?" he asked.
"Yes," Willow answered graciously. "Please do."
They settled onto the small bench, Willow crossing her legs at the ankles and folding her hands in her lap, while Jones placed his suitcase on the planks at their feet.
"I was admiring the woodwork," Jones said, patting the seat between them. "An outstanding example of care, not often seen today. I'm told your late husband is to be credited for this fine bench."
Willow beamed with pride.
"Yes," she said, "my Bobby Gray built this in 1969. All pegs and notches. Not a nail in it, you'll notice."
"Yes, I did notice," Jones replied, touching the joints with his fingers. "Beautiful. Just beautiful."
"Am I to assume you are not a local?" Willow asked.
"You are correct," Jones answered. I am not. But through the years I've been here enough to know the area, love the people, and appreciate this bench."
Willow laughed warmly. "Well, you are certainly welcome here. Jones, I believe you said?"
"Yes, ma'am. And thank you."
Willow leaned out and pointed to a rock.